Today's episode is brought to you by the NBA Store. A new year brings the start of a new NBA season. Suit up with the latest gear to show your support for your team. We may be sidelined from going to the arena, but that doesn't mean you can't watch basketball from your couch in style. We are teaming up with the NBA and Podgo to bring our listeners up to 75% off on select items. Yes, you heard that right. Go to podgo.co/NBA for up to 75% off select items from the NBA store. The NBA, where amazing happens. Hello, folks, and welcome to episode 33 of Four Quarters with Josh McKinney. I am Josh McKinney, sports editor of the Hickory Daily Record in North Carolina. Thanks for tuning in. Can't wait for you to hear what we've got today. Now, originally, I was going to do a fearless forecast and pick the winners of the two conference championship games in the NFL. I went 4-0 last week, by the way, during the divisional round. Real pumped about that. But this week, I decided I'm not going to do Fearless Forecast because I need a little bit more time to decide on my pick for the Bills-Chiefs game. As you may know, Patrick Mahomes, the quarterback for the Chiefs, the outstanding QB, went down with a concussion last game, so that may affect my pick for the game. For that reason, later in the week, I will be tweeting out my Fearless Forecast picks for both games, definitely leaning towards the Packers in the NFC over the Buccaneers, but I think that's going to be a great game as well. I'm still waffling about this pick because it's still early. Don't know my home status. So the Fearless Forecast, it moves back to Twitter just for this week. So look for that. I'll tweet that out, hashtag Fearless Forecast, and hashtag Four Quarters Pod as well in that tweet. And that's the number four. Anyway, instead of that, I'm going to have a podcast shout out to start us out. After that, this day in sports history, and then I'll be joined by my second international guest, my first Australian guest, Lachlan Everett from HoopsHabit.com is going to join me for Call of the Bullpen. We're going to talk about the NBA. He covers specifically the Memphis Grizzlies and the Toronto Raptors, so we talk about them. He's covered LaMelo Ball, who was in Australia, is now with the Charlotte Hornets. So we'll talk a little bit about him and the Hornets. And then he'll stick around for Ranky Panky as we discuss our top five head coaches in the NBA right now. Can't wait for you to hear my conversation with Lachlan. But let's get to the first segment, a podcast shout out. Okay, so for this week's podcast shout out, we haven't done one in a while. And for today's, I actually want to shout out a podcast I've shouted out before. One of my early shout outs was actually in late June of last year. The episode was called the one about Boy Meets World, if you want to go back and listen to that. It was a great episode, but at the beginning of the show, I shouted out the 3rd and 3 podcast, a great weekly podcast that covers the NFL, MLB, NBA, whatever sport is in season at the time, but really focuses hard on the NFL, especially during the season. And they do a live show once a week. Jason Fearman, Nikki G, and Damian Adams, so 3 of them, and very fun show. You never know what they're going to say. You know, it being live, it gives that extra little bit of spice to the show. They've got some really fun segments you should listen to. You can learn more about them by clicking on the link that I'll have in the episode description. As always, folks, I try to give you an idea of each segment in my shows in the description. And for this one, I will have the link to their show on Anchor, which also has other links to listen on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever else you may want to get your podcast. We're available on all those as well. And yeah, just give 3rd and 3 a listen, especially right now as the NFL comes towards the end of the season. The conference championship's coming up. They'll certainly be previewing that, hitting that hard in their next show. If you want to listen back to their divisional round preview, it's about 3 hours long, but these people are just so entertaining. It's the best place I know to go and get your NFL fix. Just put it on in the background while you're working, whatever. These guys are certainly worth listening to. Jason, Nikki, and Damien. Keep doing a great job. I won't say much more than that. I gave them a shout-out, like I said, the first show to give two shout-outs to. I just thought we might have some new listeners here in 2021. I want you to know that the Third and Three Podcast does a great job, and you can also follow them on Twitter. That's at Third and Three Podcast, and the number three for both of those. So follow them. I do, like I said, Jason, Nikki, Damien, they all have their own individual Twitters as well that you can find. But just look for Third and Three Podcast. Follow the link in the episode description. They do a great job. Entertaining, unique takes from each of the three co-hosts. And like I said, you never know what they're going to say. But always entertaining and informative. Listen to them, the Third and Three Podcast. Link in the description. And also, each of them has been a guest on my show throughout last year. Go back and find those episodes. Check them out. They're some of my favorites. So check out the episodes I've done with Jason, Nikki, and Damien. That does it for the podcast shout out to start out the show. Now, let's get to this day in sports history. We start off this week's installment of This Day in Sports History on January 20th, 1967, when Philadelphia 76ers center Wilt Chamberlain made all 15 of his field goal attempts in a 119-108 home win over the Los Angeles Lakers, setting an NBA record for consecutive shots made, a mark he topped twice himself within the next 2 months, both against the Baltimore Bullets, by making all 18 of his shots on February 24, 1967, and all 16 of his shots on March 19, 1967. The 1966-67 Sixers went on to finish 68-13 and win the second NBA title in franchise history by defeating the San Francisco Warriors in 6 games in the NBA Finals. Philadelphia also won titles in 1955 and 1983, but have returned to the finals just once in the time since, with an Allen Iverson-led team losing to the Los Angeles Lakers in 5 games in 2001. Speaking of NBA championships, Chamberlain also won one with the Lakers in 1972, when he was named Finals MVP in LA's 5-game series victory over the New York Knicks. By the way, that 18-for-18 game for Chamberlain against the Baltimore Bullets on February 24, 1967 remains the NBA record for consecutive shots made. We move 1 year later to January 20, 1968, when the University of Houston men's basketball team defeated UCLA 71-69 at the Astrodome in Houston, Texas, in front of nearly 52,700 fans in the first NCAA regular season game broadcast nationwide in prime time. Entering the game, which was billed as the game of the century, the teams were ranked number 1 and 2 in the country, with a combined record of 29-0, and UCLA was riding a 47-game winning streak that was ultimately ended by the Cougars. Dick Enberg and Bob Pettit were the game's announcers, while future number 1 overall picks in the NBA draft and Basketball Hall of Fame inductees Elvin Hayes and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was then known as Lou Alcindor, were the big men down low for Houston and UCLA, respectively. UCLA, even though they lost that particular game, would get the last laugh on the Cougars in 1968, beating them in the Final Four just over 2 months later, 101-69, before knocking off North Carolina 78-55 in the national championship game. Both of those contests were held at the LA Sports Arena, which opened in 1959 and was demolished in 2016. Next up, we go to January 20th, 1985, when the San Francisco 49ers beat the Miami Dolphins 38-16 in Super Bowl 19 at Stanford University in California. The game was the first Super Bowl in which both starting quarterbacks threw for over 300 yards as future Hall of Famers Joe Montana of the 49ers and Dan Marino of the Dolphins squared off, with Montana ultimately receiving Super Bowl MVP honors. San Francisco actually trailed 10-7 after the first quarter, before outscoring Miami 21-6 in the second quarter and 10-0 in the third, en route to a 22-point victory. Montana accounted for 390 total yards, passing for 3 touchdowns and running for another, while Marino finished with 318 passing yards and a touchdown, but also 2 interceptions and 50 total pass attempts, the latter of which represented a Super Bowl record until it was broken by the Buffalo Bills' Jim Kelly in 1992 when he threw 58 passes, and again by the New England Patriots' Tom Brady, who threw 62 passes in the Super Bowl in 2017. Montana's 4 Super Bowl wins ranked second to Brady's 6 among quarterbacks, while Marino's 155 career victories are the most by a quarterback not to win a championship. Our last event this week comes from January 20th, 1989, when Chicago Bears quarterback Nick Foles was born in Austin, Texas. A former member of the Philadelphia Eagles, who he played for twice, the St. Louis Rams, the Kansas City Chiefs, and the Jacksonville Jaguars, Foles is most known for leading the Eagles to a 41-33 win over the New England Patriots in Super Bowl 52, capturing Super Bowl MVP honors in the process. Foles completed 28 of 43 passes for 373 yards and 3 touchdowns, while also catching a 1-yard touchdown pass from tight end Trey Burton in the second quarter, becoming the first and only quarterback in Super Bowl history to catch a TD pass. Nick Foles is tied for a pair of notable NFL records, the most touchdown passes in a game with 7, and the most consecutive completions with 25. Although he ended this season backing up Mitch Trubisky in Chicago, Foles did start 7 games for the Bears earlier in the season, and has appeared in 66 games, making 55 starts over his 9-year NFL career. That's going to do it for this day in sports history. Now I'm very pleased to welcome in a guy that I had the pleasure of interviewing this past Saturday, the first Australian guest we've had, HoopsHabit.com writer Lachlan Everett. Stay tuned for Call to the Bullpen, because it's coming up right now. Well, Lachlan, want to thank you for coming on Four Quarters with Josh McKinney with me. Very excited to have our second international guest, our first from Australia. How are you doing today, man?
Yeah, doing all right. It's 12 p.m. in the Arvo, as we call it, afternoon Arvo. So, yeah, I'm doing all right. Just watched probably maybe 2.5 quarters of the Nets versus Magic, and it was pretty good.
Gotcha. Yeah, and just for reference for the listener, it's about just after 8 p.m. here Saturday night here in North Carolina, and in Australia, like you said, it's around noon, I believe, on Sunday. So listeners, reference. Lachlan, the first thing I want to ask you about is just how long you've been watching the NBA and what you like about the game of basketball.
So I'd say I started playing before I started watching. That was when I was like 14-ish. But I started watching the NBA, let's say, infrequently when I was about maybe like 15, 16. So that was 2016, 2017-ish. And then last season was my more like full season. And then this season I've been watching complete every game I can. But I've been watching basketball consistently for maybe 2-3 years, and I watched the NBL before I watched NBA fully.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the NBL a little bit, the National Basketball League. I know you're an accredited media member there.
It was last season, yes.
Yeah, explain that league just a little bit.
So it's the National Basketball League of Australia and New Zealand. New Zealand have their own NBL, which is the NZ NBL for New Zealand, but the NBL has 9 teams, and going into next season, there'll be 10. But the NBL has like two teams in Melbourne, two teams in Sydney, one in Queensland where the Great Barrier Reef is, one on the other side on the west side of Perth, a couple in between of that. And then they've got the New Zealand Breakers, which is the one international team we have currently. And then going into next season, we'll add Tasmania to the NBL, and that will become a 10-team league instead of a 9-team league, which it is now.
Cool. So what are the differences between the NBL and the NBA, for instance?
So in many international leagues, there is a limit on how many international players you can have. So in the NBL, traditionally, you can only have 3, quote, imports, which are non-Australian, non-New Zealand players, but there is some fiddling with that. There's a Japanese player in the league right now with Melbourne United. He is technically classified as a local because he is from Japan, so it's geographically local, I guess, but it's traditionally only been 3 imports, so that's typically American players coming over to the NBL, but this season it's been reduced to 2 imports due to COVID. So the league is built majoritively off Australian and New Zealand talent, more so Australian, and then there's the sprinkling of international players, and some of those guys include Scott Machado, who played with the Lakers in 2018-19, who are some other guys off the top of my head? Bryce Cotton, who has been the MVP of the league multiple times. He would be in the NBA if he wasn't 5'8". But like, there's it typically follows a pattern of either shorter point guards who are talented enough to be in the NBA, they're just a little bit short, or undersized big men such as Jarrell Martin, who recently signed with the Sydney Kings, who played with the Magic for a long time, and Cam Oliver, who's a star in the NBL and probably will be in the NBA sooner rather than later.
Gotcha. And I know you do some writing for Hoops Habit about the NBA. Just talk about what you do there and how long you've been with Hoops Habit.
I've been with Hoops Habit since June, July-ish last year, and I was originally on the Bulls beat, and then I've now moved on to the Raptors and Grizzlies beat. But it's mostly about every writer gets 1 to 3 teams, and then they cover those teams. So it's a variety of what does the starting lineup look like for the Memphis Grizzlies? How does the team adjust without Ja Morant? Or with the Raptors, my most recent piece was about Chris Boucher and how he's stepped his game up this season. But it's mostly just covering topics about the two teams. And then occasionally I sprinkle in some other stuff like LaMelo Ball, because I covered him down here. I obviously had a good understanding of what he did and what he can do. So I took on the challenge of writing the draft profiles for him for last draft. And I've been keeping an eye on him this season. And other stuff like Will Weaver was the coach of the Sydney Kings. So when he was rumored to become the Oklahoma City head coach, I wrote a coaching profile on him. This is what you need to know about Will Weaver, stuff like that. So it's the two teams I cover, the Raptors, Grizzlies, and then I sprinkle in any other knowledge I have.
Cool. Yeah, and we'll get to LaMelo some more later, me being from North Carolina, a longtime Hornets fan. I want to talk first about the Memphis Grizzlies. And, you know, I know they came into the game tonight at 5-6, were supposed to get Ja Morant back for the game. I think I just read right before we came on the air. So
he's playing at the moment, yeah.
Yeah, so playing as we're recording here. You know, he's the reigning rookie of the year, great rookie season. Played in 3 games this year before suffering a left ankle sprain. Was averaging 26.3 points, 6.3 assists. I just want to talk about Ja Morant first and what you've seen from him, what his ceiling maybe is as a player, in your opinion.
Well, we obviously haven't seen much of him this year, but in the small sample we saw, he looked better. He just looked more controlled, which is something people worried about. I especially saw all of the Derrick Rose PTSD that people were having when Ja Morant went up to the ring, but in the small sample we saw, he was shooting a little bit better, just more consistent, turning the ball over a little bit less, but not by much. Last season, the biggest things he had to work on was the man-to-man defense, the turnovers, and the three-point percentage. And in the small sample we saw, he was doing that a little bit better, but he obviously had to carry the team without Jaren Jackson Jr. in the lineup. So he will come back into the team still without Jaren Jackson Jr., but we've seen Xavier Tillman take on a much bigger role as the backup center. Gorgui Dieng has been benched, more or less. And then Desmond Bain has come out shooting lights out. He looks like the 3-and-D wing that we all projected going into the draft, and it's been interesting to watch how they survived without Ja Morant, because it looked like the team was going to be on IV drip, but it actually has been okay with Jonas Valanciunas, Kyle Anderson, Dylan Brooks stepping up in a bigger role.
Yeah, I know the Grizzlies last season just missed out on the playoffs, really. They were the 8th seed going into the bubble, finished as number 9 and lost that play-in game to the Portland Trailblazers. What did you think of the team last year? Do you think they kind of maybe exceeded expectations a little bit, being that close to the playoffs?
It all hinged on Morant. No one expected Morant to do that. It's very rare for an NBA rookie point guard to produce at the level he did and actually do it in an efficient and winning way. So that's mostly on Ja Morant, but Jaren Jackson Jr. stepped up as well, just a little bit, but he was already very good. And then has to go credit to Taylor Jenkins for adapting the team around Ja Morant when you drafted him a few months prior, and he comes out playing like he did. So the team won a lot of its games because of paint points. They led the league last season, and they're either leading or damn close without Ja Morant right now. But that's back to Jonas Valanciunas being a very underrated center, and without them, they've had to rely on him for the paint scoring. But I think last season, it was mostly on Ja Morant to do what he did, and he did it, and that's really good. But obviously, being who he is, he's going to get injured from occasion. So it takes the Grizzlies. They have to step up when he's out, and it's unfortunate that Winslow hasn't played yet or Jaren Jackson hasn't played yet. But everything last season was around him, but all of the complementary pieces played up really well, and Taylor Jenkins actually put a team around it and did it really well around Ja Morant.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about Jonas Valanciunas. You know, he's a guy who, like you said, doesn't get a ton of coverage being where he's at, but I've been really impressed with what I've seen out of him in the post for Memphis.
Yeah, it's a little bit plays in Memphis, a little bit international player, a little bit everyone wrote him off because he was the backup center for the Raptors, but he's been really good for the post. He's more efficient than you'd think in the post. There's only a couple handful of guys in the league who are efficient in the post. He is close to being efficient in the post, which is all you can ask for in today's era. But he added a 3-point shot over the past maybe 3-2 seasons, and he's up to roughly 1.7 attempts per game, and he's making 30% of those. So it's an added dynamic to his game, and he's still a very good post defender. I wouldn't trust him in the pick and roll defense switching, but that's why you have Jaren Jackson and such. But he's added a 3-point shot. He can still defend the post. He's a rebounding machine, so they're not giving up offensive boards at all. So he does all the little things you need. He set some of the best screens in the league. There was one play in particular where Dylan Brooks set a back screen for him in a cross the paint, and then Jonas just cut the ball and put it straight up. So it's his play is infectious to the team, and it's really valuable, especially without Morant.
Yeah, and so that's Memphis a little bit. I want to talk about the Toronto Raptors as well. Have struggled early this season. We're 3-8 entering the game that's going on now against Charlotte, and won the NBA title a couple years ago. Kind of surpassed expectations last year without Kawhi Leonard. What are your early thoughts on Toronto this season?
They've relied on the three a lot. I feel like I can't check off the top of my head, but it's top 5 in 3-point attempts. They are jacking shots because I think without Gasol, without Ibaka, they've lacked an interior presence, and they haven't had Marc Gasol post touches to cut in that. But Fred VanVleet has probably been the best player for them so far, I'd say, overall. He's been shooting lights out. He's been running the team. Lowry's been in and out, but Lowry is probably your best player. Pascal's been doing his best, but he's struggling in those. He missed 2 shots in a row in back-to-back 1-point games, and I don't know if he's ready to be a closer or he ever will be. And that's why I think Fred VanVleet was essential as a signing for the Raptors, because he was able to set up Pascal. And I think if you have Fred VanVleet Pascal Siakam OG, if he takes another step, like that core is going to be really well, then you hopefully entice a free agent. But I think the Raptors' biggest issue has been inconsistency, not getting into the paint enough, not getting to the free throw line. There was one game where Pascal only went twice, Fred VanVleet only went three times. They need to get in there, and I don't know what's specifically happening with that, because they have Aaron Baines, but he's not playing due to inconsistency, per Nick Nurse. So it's a bit of a struggle trying to figure out who they are post Gasol and Ibaka.
Yeah, and I know you mentioned this guy's name earlier, Chris Boucher. Talk about what you've seen from him. He's kind of come out of nowhere for Toronto.
Yeah, obviously the Raptors lost their two centers in free agency to the LA's respectively, and then that left them with Aaron Baines as their projected starting center, and for a variety of reasons, he's not playing very much. Him and Alex Len have received a lot of DNPs, and Alex Len was signed as insurance to Baines because he's been injury prone the past few years. But leaving that, you've got Aaron Baines being inconsistent, so he's a DNP. You've got Alex Len, who's not someone I imagine Nick Nurse can trust overly. So that's let Chris Boucher, who averaged 11 minutes per game last season, to step up as their crunch time center. He's started in multiple second halves, but he hasn't started actual games. There was a game, the best example I have is when they played the Trailblazers. Nurkic got injured halfway through the second, I believe, and then they had Alex Len match his minutes. And then when Nurkic went out, he didn't play again. Boucher took over as center for the rest of the game. So he's your switchable center who's just been on fire from three, over 40%. And he's been your switchable defensive center, and he's been blocking shots left, right, and center. He's been catapulting threes like it's nobody's business. He's come out shooting really well. He's been a much better defender. And I think the biggest difference for him is getting those minutes, getting comfortable, and he's running pick and rolls really well with Fred VanVleet for it specifically as well.
Yeah. And so we talk about the Raptors, and like I said, as we're recording, they are playing the Charlotte Hornets for the second time in 3 days. The Hornets are 6-7 entering this game, and I know you've in particular followed LaMelo Ball in Australia, and now again here with the Hornets. And recently became the youngest player to get a triple-double in an NBA game. And a lot of talk has been, you know, he's been coming off the bench. Should he be a starter, or should he keep coming off the bench? What do you think?
This was the focus of my second most recent piece, I believe. But this was maybe 4 games ago when that piece came out. And at that point, he was shooting 45% from three, which was remarkable considering what I saw down here. But there's things that carried over with the defense. He still struggles defensively. He's not a complete liability, but he still struggles man-to-man. He still struggles off-ball. He gets lost. When he's defending the corner, for example, he just goes into the paint and just leaves Matt Thomas in the corner or Landry Shamet in the corner. He just gets drawn in ball watching. But the things that have impressed me is the passing was always going to translate. That wasn't a question. But he's turning the ball over a lot less, which is really impressive considering how turnover prone he was in the NBL. But when it comes to defense, I don't know if he's going to start because I wouldn't trust him defensively. And during that first few game stretch, he wasn't in crunch time at all. But now I can't pronounce his name, but the coach, James, he's trusted him in late game minutes, and now he's actually playing huge minutes for them, and he's been quite productive. But the 3-point has come off significantly. It's down to 33% when it was up to 45, so he's that leveled out by like the percentages because he's taking so many deep shots, and some of them are contested, some of them he's like 3 feet behind the line. And he was doing that in the NBL, and it was even worse back then. So he's making him a little bit more, but he needs to be working on the catch and shoot. He needs to be working on actually having his feet on the line because he's going to be so far out that no one's going to defend him, and that just ruins the spacing.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about those three teams. I want to talk about the big trade that happened earlier this week. James Harden sent from the Houston Rockets to the Brooklyn Nets to join Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving if he shows up again. What are your thoughts on, you know, these are obviously three very ball-dominant players. Do you think these three can coexist there in Brooklyn?
We've never seen three players who've historically had that level of usage play together, and that's definitely a challenge for Steve Nash. And if there's anyone who could figure it out, I'd hope it'd be Steve Nash and his coaching staff, but I'm hesitant to say it will work. I'd love to see it work because that would be the most beautiful basketball ever. But to see Kevin Durant, like, he's going to have to space and play off the ball. He's the only guy who's ever played off the ball, like, happily and consistently with the Warriors. Kyrie Irving has always wanted the ball in his hands. And even when he was playing with LeBron, he was pouting at times off the ball. And James Harden's James Harden. Like, it is some of the stuff you see when he's off the ball, it's despicable. He's not cutting. He is not moving. He just stands up there waiting for the ball to be delivered back to him. So I hope Steve Nash can get those guys motivated to move off the ball. Because if you have KD setting a screen while Kyrie Irving goes around and James Harden cuts, what the hell are you going to do? And we saw that with Team USA like a few months ago. I wrote, can this work with between Kyrie and Steve Nash? And I asked Chris Ancy, who's an Australian legend and played with Steve Nash. It's Kyrie's always been a pain in the ass to deal with. And he cited Phil Handy, who was the Lakers assistant coach. He had to deal with him down here and he said he was a pain in the ass. So I don't know how it will work, but we saw with Team USA in 2016, like there was stuff where like KD would set a screen for Kyrie in the middle and then like Kyrie would come off and to the 3-point line and just take it. It's like, if you get that ball movement, you get that back screen stuff, you get DJ involved with Harden while you have the other two on the offside, like you can't defend that. I just really hope they figure it out.
Yeah. One thing that concerns me about the trade is what they gave up. You know, they're not going to have the depth that they had before the trade. And, you know, we saw two other teams get involved in that trade as well with Cleveland and Indiana. Indiana sending Victor Oladipo to Houston, and I think that was a solid pickup for them. You know, a guy who doesn't have a big ego and is a pretty solid NBA player. So what were your thoughts on Houston getting Oladipo and getting a ton of draft picks as well?
When it comes to that, it obviously comes down to two things. It's, do you want those 8 draft picks and Victor Oladipo for possibly 2 years and you flip him for more draft picks or re-sign him or something? Or do you want Ben Simmons? That's what it comes down to. And the Rockets chose that. I don't know if it was apparently that Philly didn't want to give up Tyrese Maxey or something like that, but it seems like Houston were happy with taking Victor Oladipo and all that draft capital. And if I was them, I would have taken Ben Simmons. Like, there is a question about his jump shot, but there's no question about anything else. That dude's all NBA, all defensive team. There's no guarantee that Victor Oladipo ever gets back to the level he did. There's no guarantee those draft picks, which many of them are going to be in the 20s from the Bucks and the Nets for the few couple of years, there's no guarantee they turn into Ben Simmons. So if you're going off what actually happened, I think it's a good move. I think Oladipo adds an element that they didn't have before, if you don't count James Harden, because he wasn't going to play properly. But if you have all of that, and if I was them, I'd probably try and move on from Victor, get a good couple months season out of him and then trade him for more assets and then just go into the complete hoard all of your assets with all your young guys. Because I love Jayshon Tate. He was down here. There's a bunch of young, like, they've got Christian Wood you can build around. John Wall can be your stabilizer in that young team. It's an interesting thing, and I'm interested to see how it works. But I think it all comes down to, what did you get for James Harden? We're going to look back on that trade in 20 years, and if it's picks and Victor Oladipo, like, this is the Cleveland Isaiah Thomas Kyrie trade. It's like, what did Cleveland get? Maybe, like, Colin Sexton. That's pretty much it. We're going to look back at 20 years ago, wow, that was a bad trade. We're going to look back at 20 years on this, and we're going to see if Houston got something or if they didn't get a Ben Simmons.
Yep, we'll see how that works out, obviously, in the future. Now, we want to talk about the defending NBA champions, the Los Angeles Lakers. Your early takeaways for them this year, and what do you think their chances are to repeat this year?
They look the same, but they look better. That's pretty much it. Like Anthony Davis, he's been on autopilot and they still look good. Like LeBron's come out. I think a lot of players suffered from not knowing when the season started. Like Luka, you could see he's clearly out of shape, but he's still Luka. So when we get into the middle of the season, I think the Mavs will look better. But like LeBron, he's ready every day at every second to play basketball. He looks after himself that much. So the Lakers look good. They look better, honestly. Gasol adds this whole other dynamic that they've never had before. Montrez, I think Bill Simmons brought this up, but you need the Montrez Harrells of the world in a season without fans. Like, you need that energy to drive off. And the Lakers had a very good bench last season during the bubble. And I think that artificial crowd that you can make within your team is really important for this season, especially we've seen all the blowouts. So you have Montrez. Dennis Schroeder is hungry to start, so he's going to ball out as much as he can. I think they're just improved overall. Like, I don't know who the threats are, but I'd say the Nets are real. They're a real threat. The Suns are real. I don't know if they're a threat, but they're a real team. I've lost faith in the Clippers. They've blown two huge leads. They've lost by 50 points. I wonder how it works, but I feel like they need a creator, like a Patty Mills. If he's available, I would grab Patty Mills in a heartbeat. Another creator off the ball, someone who can handle the ball, someone who could set up, like, and someone who could be a leader. Like, Kawhi is not a verbal leader. You need that leader. I think Patty Mills would be perfect. And then the dark horses are the Mavs. If Luka gets in shape and looks better, Kristaps looks better. And then Philly, like Joel Embiid, Anthony Davis, that's a perfect matchup to see who can outplay each other. Ben Simmons versus LeBron. And then it's up to who can make more shots on the perimeter. And I think Philly have better shooters than the Lakers do.
Like you said, it's going to be interesting to see how things play out. Obviously, I think the Lakers have a great chance to repeat, barring any major injuries or anything on their part. And like you said, I like some of the teams you named. Obviously, Brooklyn's a major threat in the Eastern Conference this year that everybody is, a lot of people are hopping on that bandwagon. We'll see.
Well, they're a major threat complete. If it works, I don't see how they don't win. But that's the thing. It's got to work. They got to figure out defense. They traded away their best defender, Jared Allen. There is no one on that team I trust on the perimeter. I'd say KD, but I don't want him being a primary defender for a season and a playoff series. They need defense, and they need to figure it out offensively. So there's a lot to do, but it's there.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to get into the other segment I talked about us doing. It's called Ranky Panky. So what we're going to do is rank our top five current NBA head coaches. I'll start it out, first of all, with some of the honorable mention I've got that didn't quite make my list. It was really hard to leave some of these guys off the top five. But the first guy I've got is Mike Budenholzer from Milwaukee.
That's a given, yeah.
Yeah, you know, he's led them to back-to-back number one seeds in the Eastern Conference. Did the same for the Atlanta Hawks 5 or 6 years ago, I believe. 51 years old, a longtime assistant to Greg Popovich there in San Antonio. And so I've got him just missing my top five. I've got Quinn Snyder from Utah Jazz, 54 years old, seventh year with Utah right now. I'm a Duke fan, and he played at Duke. Was an assistant there under Coach K for much of the 1990s, and they've had 4 straight winning seasons. I really like the young team they've got there in Utah. And my last honorable mention is Mike Malone for the Denver Nuggets, 50 years old. They also had the great series in the playoffs last year with Utah that went 7 games.
Well, they had two great series.
Yeah, they had two great series coming back from 3-1 down to both Utah and the Clippers, which was the...
We got to acknowledge, though, they didn't have Bogdan Bogdanovic. They didn't have their... He was a 20-point-per-game scorer. Right. I feel like that's going to be lost to history, but we do need to acknowledge they didn't have one of their 20-point-per-game scorers, but Jamal Murray went nuts. So I call it even, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Just love that young team and Murray and Jokic in the middle. But those are my honorable mentions that didn't make my list. Do you have anybody you want to talk about?
So I've got my snubs and then my honorable mentions. So my snubs would be Brad Stevens and Rick Carlisle. So I'd say Stevens has been great having these two young wings in Brown and Tatum take off, and all credit to Brown for the step he's taken. They've done their best without Kemba. Marcus Smart has, you know, done his best point guard impression, but it hasn't exactly worked. But I'd say those two, I have to mention them because of their status, but I still think there's been some other guys who have been better. Nate Bjorgen, I believe that's how you say it, the Pacers coach. I love what he's doing with the Pacers. Mm-hmm. He's taken away the mid-range shots and put it into the three-point line. So they're taking way more threes. They're taking less mids. That's really helped Domantas Sabonis become who he is. I think Malcolm Brogdon has just been steady this whole time. He's always been steady. And I think Caris LeVert, hopefully he gets that injury, the mass on his kidney sorted out. That was really annoying to hear about. He's having a mass on your kidney is not good news, no matter who you are, but especially for him with his injury history, I hope he gets better, but he adds a whole nother dynamic. Miles Turner has been motivated by the Gordon Hayward rumors to come out and block every shot he possibly can. So I'd say he's a special mention. JB Bickerstaff with the Cavs, they are playing defense, and I love that for the Cavs. They need it if they're going to play Colin Sexton and Darius Garland a lot. Good old Sexland. Taylor Jenkins, obviously, for everything we've said. And Steven Silas for handling the situation. But in the games I've watched without Harden, he is playing the ball he wanted to, and it is beautiful. I love how he plays. He defense first, ball movement with John Wall, Boogie, Christian Wood. And they've brought in Jayshon Tate, who is an NBL player, and he's come into the NBA and he's balling out. I love Jayshon Tate. He's a Draymond Green, PJ Tucker hybrid, and he's really good. So I have to say those are my honorable mentions.
Okay. And I know you mentioned this guy's name, so before I get to my number five, I want to talk about Gordon Hayward, the big move there coming to my Charlotte Hornets, a hometown team. A lot of people talk, was it the right move or not? I love it because the Hornets, not known for their superstars over the years for sure, would have liked to have seen.
Well, you had one, but you let him go.
Yeah, Kemba Walker. And obviously I would have loved to have seen a guy like Hayward playing alongside him, which they did in Boston, but would have been nice to see in Charlotte. Your thoughts on the Hornets bringing in Hayward in his play so far?
Well, we all know Gordon's good. We all know he's a very good player. It's just he's been snake bit in Boston. He got injured all the time. And then he went from, you got to remember, he signed with Boston to be the first second option next to Isaiah Thomas. How long ago was that? The Isaiah Thomas being your star player with the Celtics. So when he signed, he was doing that with Isaiah. Then it turned into Kyrie. And then it turned into an injury. And then it turned into Jason Tatum becoming a superstar. And then Jaylen Brown takes another step. So by the end of his tenure, he went from being the 1B option next to Isaiah to being the 4th or 5th option. And I think that's a huge adjustment for anyone, especially over that time. So I think to get your own team, to get paid, to be on your own team and take pressure off the young guys, especially LaMelo, it's been good for the Hornets. It's been good for him. I just hope he can either get them to the playoffs or in his later stage of his career work and be on a contender, sort of like a Boris Diaw with the Spurs. Just be that like six-man, steady, off-the-bench guy. But I think for the Hornets, they're not going to get free agents. So I think overpaying Hayward is something you have to do. But if you wanted to focus LaMelo Ball's development, I think signing Hayward is redundant because he wants to win. And I think giving LaMelo the keys is not a way to win. So there's a weird dynamic going on there, but I think it can work because I really trust the coach that he knows what he's doing with that team.
I agree, and I think it was a great move to bring Gordon in, a good guy in the locker room, and going to give you solid performances for sure. I want to get back to our list now, the top five current NBA head coaches. We've named our honorable mentions. You name a couple snubs. One of your snubs, I believe, was Rick Carlisle for the Dallas Mavericks. He's my number five.
I can't argue with that.
Yeah, been a head coach since 2001, 61 years old. Started with Detroit, then Indiana, and now been with Dallas for
a gazillion 13th,
years. Yeah, 13th year, I believe. It seems like longer, honestly. But 14 winning seasons and 18 years as a head coach. And obviously the 2011 NBA title when they beat Miami's Big Three, his biggest accomplishment. And that team was a lot of fun to watch. But I've got Rick Carlisle at number five. Who have you got at number five?
Yeah, I've got Nick Nurse. I just have to credit his defense. He has the zaniest defensive strategies I've ever seen from an NBA head coach, and it works. And he's obviously got the pedigree of the championship in 2019. And I think last season will be forgotten to history. But if you combine the amount of games Serge Ibaka, Marc Gasol, Kyle Lowry, Fred VanVleet, Pascal Siakam missed, all of those guys, Norman Powell, it's like over 200 games total. So they got the second best seed in the East behind the Bucks with 200 games missed with all from a collection of their best players. So that will be lost to history, but Nick Nurse is a top five head coach in this league, and it shows. He struggled at the start of this season, but I don't blame the Raptors. The amount of rigmarole they've gone through, going Florida, all of this border stuff, it's hard to blame them specifically. There are some stuff, but I still think, above all, he is a top five head coach in this league.
I agree, and he'll be on my list a little later, so I'll get to that then. First one to mention, my number four. If I was looking at this list, like, all time, who I think's the greatest, this guy may be the greatest head coach ever in the NBA, and that's Greg Popovich for the Spurs. I've got him at four just because I looked at the list, like, who would I most want as my head coach right now, building for the future?
That's the same idea.
Yeah. And so he's 72 years old, but obviously a legend. Been in San Antonio since 1996. Five NBA titles, six finals appearances. I know they had made the playoffs 22 straight seasons before last year. And
23, I believe, but one or the other.
22, 23, something like that. But third all-time in wins for a head coach behind Don Nelson and Lenny Wilkins. So I've got Popovich at number four. Who have you got?
Frank Vogel. I have to credit the most recent champion. I don't know how much he had an influence on LeBron buying in defensively, but LeBron saw that roster and knew they could defend, so he bought in. And I have to credit Frank Vogel for really pushing that. That Lakers team is one of the best defensive teams I've seen in a very long time. And they had great defenders. They had those centers, JaVale, Dwight, and AD. And they had those perimeter, Danny Green, Avery Bradley, who did play in the bubble. But they really focused defense. This season, they've adjusted. They've adjusted well. They've added more offense and less defense. But they've kept up that Lakers brand of hard-nosed defense. But now they're a little bit more versatile. So I think Frank Vogel is a top five head coach, but I think he's done something special with that team. And I don't know how much you credit LeBron, not how much you credit him, but no matter what, I think he's one of the best coaches LeBron's had in his career.
Well, that leads me to my number three. And another guy you mentioned earlier is Brad Stevens for the Boston Celtics, a guy who is one of the few to be successful both in college and in the pros. They haven't reached the NBA Finals yet, but three Eastern Conference Finals appearances with a young team. He's only 44. I mean, the last five seasons, they've averaged just over 50 wins a season. So he's taken a team that, when he got there, was one of the worst in the NBA, and they're now one of the top teams in the Eastern Conference. So I've got Brad Stevens at number three.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. He's done a very good job. He's from that 2013 era where it was Jared Sullinger playing center to now you've got Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. So it's hard to argue.
All right, you're number three.
I have to go with Steve Kerr. He's done such a magnificent job with that roster over the past few years, taking over from Mark Jackson and continuing that, handling the egos of all of those guys, which definitely he learned from Phil and Phil Jackson, that is. I think this season's been a unique puzzle without Clay. And last season, they tried their best, but they couldn't. But this season, Kerr has a few puzzles to figure out. He has the Kelly Oubre jigsaw puzzle. He has the Rubik's Cube of Andrew Wiggins to figure out. But you've got Steph Curry, you've got Draymond, you've got James Wiseman. You've got to figure out that. And he's done pretty well so far. It's a beautiful team to watch. They have beautiful movement. And I think Kerr, as well as Curry, are going to be on somewhat of a revenge tour while they wait for Clay to come out of the hangers.
Yeah, they certainly seem to be that way. Curry's playing out of his mind early in the season. So, and another guy who's from North Carolina, so I've followed him since he was at Davidson. So happy to see that. Number two for me is another guy you mentioned, Nick Nurse of Toronto Raptors. I've got him. He's 53 years old, third year with the Raptors after five seasons as an assistant there. led them to the first ever NBA title in 2019. Combined record of 111-43 over his first two seasons. And Toronto was the number two seed in the East both years. Won that title with Kawhi Leonard and then lost Kawhi and took Boston to seven games last season in the second round of the playoffs and kind of, I think, exceeded expectations last year. I think Nick Nurse is a huge reason why. Love him and his basketball mind. So I've got him at two. Who have you got?
I got Spo, Eric Spoelstra. I think that the thing when I think of Spo is I think of that 2016-2017 team that was, I think they, what was it? It was like the record was like 17 wins or something, and then they went off on this like 33-game stretch and they made the playoffs with that Deion Waiters, like Tyler Johnson, like Hassan Whiteside era, and like he had to handle LeBron. That was the moment, the ultimatum, where LeBron said, come on, come coach. Pat Riley said, no, Spo was your coach. And since then he's been working his ass off as a coach, and it all paid off, I think, last season, as this is what we could expect going forward with that Bam, Jimmy, Goran Dragic. And he's gotten the best out of Duncan Robinson. He's gotten the best out of Tyler Hero. I think we have to give him his dues of he's not LeBron's coach, he's his own coach, which I assume everyone believed, but I don't know if that's said enough. So I have him at two, especially after the bubble run.
Yeah, absolutely. And that leads me perfectly in the number one, because mine is Eric Spoelstra of the Miami Heat. Five Eastern Conference titles, two NBA titles, obviously with those LeBron, Wade, Bosch teams. He's now 50 years old. Has just two losing seasons in 12 years as a head coach. And last year, one of his best coaching jobs as a number five seed in the Eastern Conference, Miami within just a couple wins of winning a title against that Lakers team. And, you know, a guy who worked his way up through Miami's organization, been there since the late 90s. And I really am impressed with the way he worked his way up to becoming their head coach. So I've got Spo at number one. Who have you got?
Pop. I can't disrespect Pop. I just, I think for all the success he's had, I think these past two, three seasons have been very interesting. He made LaMarcus Aldridge and DeMar DeRozan, two mid-range, not defensive players, work like the past two seasons. Like, he's a genius. It's not like that's obvious, but to get those guys to work, to not shoot, to shoot the most mid-range shots and still be a good team is something I really am intrigued by. And this season has been very interesting with the youth movement. You've got Keldon Johnson, you've got Lonnie Walker, you've got all those guys, Derek White, Dejounte Murray, they've all stepped up. And there's this youth movement where they're running, like huge. They're running. They've got some of the highest pace in the league. I can't double check off the top of my head, but they're running really hard, and they've got DeMar playing power forward. They've got LaMarcus at center permanently. And then they've got that bench unit with Patty. They've got Jakob Poeltl. Like, that's a really good, it's a really fun, it's a league pass team. It's not a winning team, but it's a league pass team. But I think that shows Pop coached slow. He coached defensively, and now he switched gears with the roster he's had to play with. And I think that shows his versatility. It shows how good of a coach he is. And remember the rumors about him possibly being the Nets coach? It's like, yeah, you put him with Kyrie and Durant, he'll figure it out. And we've seen this season, it's been a troubling season for the Nets to deal with all the egos and how they work. So if they thought Pop was going to fix that, I think that speaks credit to how good he is. And I don't think the Spurs will make it, but my God, they're fun. And he's let Patty off the leash, which I'm very happy with, because if people don't know, Team USA played in Melbourne against the Australian Boomer national team, and Patty Mills outplayed Kemba Walker in one of those games and scored 30 on Team USA and did it right in front of Pop. And in the press conference, Pop goes, oh, yeah, he's a pain in the ass to play against. It's Patty Mills has been the consummate teammate, and now he's letting him run like loose off the bench. And it's just been a real joy. It's been a joy to watch. And I think that's an important thing for Pop. Like, it's just been fun to watch.
Don't hate that pick at all at number one. Obviously a huge fan of Pop, and he's a legendary coach for sure. Just real quick, I'm going to go back through my top five from five to one. I had Rick Carlisle, Greg Popovich, Brad Stevens, Nick Nurse, and Eric Spoelstra. Go back through your top five.
So I have Nick Nurse at 5, Vogel at 4, Kerr at 3, Spoelstra at 2, and Pop at 1.
Awesome. I think it's a solid list on both sides. Obviously, some guys that overlap for the two of us, but some great head coaches. And this was harder than I thought it might be when I sat down and started thinking about who I had to leave off and everything. Just a lot of great.
Yeah, I had a list of 10 people, and I sort of just had to brainstorm, had to go, well, this or that, or take something off there, and that's the list I ended up with.
Awesome. Well, Lachlan, before I let you go, I want you to go through any social media or anything that you have that people can follow you at and can read some of your work.
So the best way to find me is at Twitter, at Lachie Everett, LachieEverett. And I pinned the tweet of my most recent piece on my Twitter account. So if you want to read that, that's there on my pinned tweet. But most recent was on Chris Boucher and his emergence. And I think it's the sudden emergence of Chris Boucher. And I had a lot of fun putting that together. I spoke to a lot of like Eric Corrine. I tried to get like all these people to try and talk about it. But if you're interested in the Grizzlies, you're interested in the Raptors, interested in a bit of LaMelo Ball here and there, or keep an eye out on Josh Giddey and Mojave King, the two guys who are playing in Australia, who are going to be the next stars, like the guys who are going to come into the draft. I'll be writing draft profiles on them. So Twitter, at Lachie Everett, you'll see all my stuff there.
Great. Well, I checked out some of your work on Hoops Habit throughout the week leading up to our interview. Really enjoyed it. I think you do solid work, and just keep up the good work. Thank you for coming on the podcast with me, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You take care.
You too.
Well, that's all we've got for this week on episode 33 of Four Quarters with Josh McKinney. You know what that means? 34 is up next week. Can't wait for that. It's a professional wrestling-based show coming at you in 7 days. I'll have a guest. John Alba will join me. He's a fellow podcaster, fellow professional wrestling fan. Actually, one of three co-hosts of a weekly wrestling podcast that comes out every Tuesday. It's called Living the Gimmick. More about that next week. More about John, and I'll get his take on the build to the Royal Rumble, and tons of professional wrestling talk coming at you. I know it's been a while since I've done a podcast that was professional wrestling based, but we've done a few last year. Really have enjoyed it. So Talking Smack with J-Mac is that segment's name. It returns next week. Ranky Panky as well. This Day in Sports History and more coming up next week on Four Quarters with Josh McKinney. But before we get there, another special thanks to my guest today, Lachlan Everett, the Australian basketball writer for HoopsHabit.com. Check out his work, please, folks. Remember to follow me on Twitter at SuperJMac32, like Four Quarters with Josh McKinney on Facebook. I'm back at you in 7 days, like I said, with John Alba. We're here every Wednesday for you, Four Quarters with Josh McKinney. I am your host, sports editor of the Hickory Daily Record in North Carolina, Josh McKinney, signing off. Can't wait to come at you again next week. Take care, folks.